Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Now, the Taoiseach and the Thánaiste are seeking cabinet approval this morning for more than €50 million to be invested in cross-border projects. But the programme for government includes no mention of Irish unity beyond committing to the unity of the people. Now, a Fine Gael colleague asked about the Thánaiste's position, reportedly stated bluntly, Simon Harris is not interested in this period. So are we turning our backs on Irish unity, or are we just quietly acknowledging that we may want unity in theory, but we're not prepared to pay the bills and make the sacrifices necessary to deliver it? Well, to discuss this, I'm joined in the studio by Mark Hennessy from the Irish Times and from Belfast by Professor of British and Irish Politics at the University of Liverpool, John Tong. And you're both welcome to the programme. I'll come back to Simon Harris's view on this in a moment, Mark, but just that €50 million in the Shared Islands scheme. I mean, is the government sending a clear signal here, in your view, that it is going to continue to pursue this softly investment-led approach to the border question?
Yeah, although you could argue that the 50 million is a small portion of the 1 billion that is due to go to Shared Island during the course of the lifetime of this government. Government will obviously argue that you have to do it with one project after another and make sure that everything is dotted and i'd and all the rest of it. But certainly there's no appetite on the part of either Micheál Martin or Simon Harris for a constitutional discussion. And particularly in the case of Micheál Martin, Shared Island was his baby. He set it up in 2019 with very small money, you remember, so small that many people in his own party were deeply critical of him. And that was not accidental. It was done deliberately to show that it wasn't threatening, it wasn't a Trojan horse to unionists, and that it was about a shared advantage. And over a period of years, quite a few people on the unionist side who didn't engage with it at the beginning are engaging with it now. The Orange Order, for instance, in the early days wouldn't touch it with a barge pole. You know, 3 years later, they're inviting Micheál Martin into their headquarters in Belfast. So from that point of view, it has proven to be very, very successful in convincing people that there's a conversation to be had about cooperation on the island. That is not a constitutional question. It's a question about shared resources and shared use of services.
And Simon Harris, then, his view on unity and where he views it on his workload?
Well, he doesn't, quite frankly, but... And I say this not as a criticism. I mean, if you look at Micheál Martin in his 60s, child of the Troubles in many ways, used to go to Belfast as an Ogra Fianna Fáil member. You know, he ate and drank this stuff. Simon Harris is 38. He's, you know, but whatever age he was when the Good Friday Agreement came out. This is not part of his radar in quite the same way. And he made the point, for which he was extremely criticised, although he was right, that a large number of most young people in Ireland would know more about Paris or Berlin than they would know about Belfast. There are a lot of people on the island who wouldn't like that sentiment, but it is largely accurate. Now, the point about this is that we can have whatever discussion we want to have about unity in the Republic or not have. We're entitled to ignore it. But we have no say on whether a referendum ever happens or not. That will be a decision that will happen in Northern Ireland, and we will then have to deal with the consequences of that. Micheál Martin, clearly, and he's the leading figure in the South on this, does not want to do anything that will in any way spur that unity conversation. He wants to keep it on the basis of shared actions and cooperation wherever possible.
So remember back to all the rows over Brexit. I mean, United Ireland was very firmly on the agenda then. I mean, it was a great fear of unionists. It was seen by some here, moderate nationalists, who would have said, well, this is the way to solve the problem.
Yeah, and that sentiment is still around, although the polling figures would tend to argue that the support for unity in the North has slightly, maybe just ever so fractionally tempered, because Brexit has gone off the agenda. The Windsor framework appears to be showing signs of reasonably working. Now, if you look at the Aaron's polling with the Irish Times, support there has, over a period of 3 years in Northern Ireland for unity, has gone from 27% to 34% over that full period. Now, that's important. That's not a majority. That's not even an argument that you could make to the Secretary of State. You must call a referendum on these figures. Mm-hmm. It doesn't go anywhere even remotely close to it. But if you fast forward 5 years, 10 years, if those sort of incremental changes continue to happen, then we start getting into early 40s support in Northern Ireland. That argument to a Secretary of State for on whether he or she should call a referendum becomes much harder to avoid from the British point
nothing,
of view.
But nothing can compel the Secretary of State to make that call on the referendum.
That's arguable, because what it says is that the Secretary of State shall call if, and then the next bit is a subjective judgment, if in their mind a question once put would pass. So
it depends who's in the job.
It is, but Sinn Féin, Piers Doherty was speaking at Glenties Summer School last year, and he did talk, you know, not absolutely openly, but he certainly gave strong indications that Sinn Féin and others on the nationalist Republican side would see a benefit in perhaps going to court at some point in the years ahead to put some sort of guardrails around the Secretary of State and say, well, what are the mechanics that you're going to
use?
And the parameters.
Yeah, how will this be decided? Let's bring John in on this. Hello, John. Good to have you with us.
Good morning.
So you've heard there that the government strategy seems to be this gently investment in the shared island structure, keep it going, it's acceptable to unionists. Is that wise after the friction of the Brexit years to pursue that strategy rather than a conversation around flags and identity and anthems and so on?
Yeah, because I think the Irish government doesn't want to unsettle things in the north. Micheál Martin is probably the least gung-ho for Irish unity that you've ever had as a Fianna Fáil leader. The days when a Fianna Fáil Ardéis would rise to its feet when its leader, you know, called for British withdrawal from Northern Ireland, it does belong to a bygone pre-Good Friday agreement era. I mean, it's on the Fine Gael side, ironically, you had someone who was slightly more gung-ho for unity with Leo Varadkar, who's, you know, was quite adamant that he did want to see a united Ireland in his lifetime. But the policy of the Irish government really is softly. It's about cross-border projects. It's about a shared island. It's not about the exercise of Irish national sovereignty over the 32 counties. Why is that? Well, given that there's a clear majority, every single poll in the Republic has shown a majority in favour of Irish unity. But that majority does tend to not dissipate, but decline when the costs and caveats of unity are added to it. I mean, there isn't a prospectus written for Irish unity either, and I don't think there's any way that Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael are going to write that prospectus. So it will be left to Sinn Féin and Ireland's future to write that prospectus. And there's no agreement over what the cost of a united Ireland would be. You've had two respected economists differing wildly in their estimation of the cost of a united Ireland. John Doyle at Dublin City University, he put the cost recently at only €2.5 billion, which isn't, you know, inordinately expensive. Whereas John Fitzgerald at the Institute of International and European Affairs, he put the cost at closer to €20 billion of a united Ireland.
And there were a lot of rows over that figure. Views.
Yeah, exactly. So if you can't get consensus amongst economists over the cost would be, that's the uncertainty that is already there before that prospectus has been written.
Just going back to Micheál Martin, Mark, I know you interviewed him at length last year about what he sees as the future for Northern Ireland and the Republic. And he said to you that he believes in uniting people. What was your sense of his vision here?
Well, it's not unity in the short term or even in the medium term. It is a question of trying to cooperate with people wherever it's possible to do. And that's one of the reasons why the A5 project, the nursing and doctor training that we're paying for in the north, and to create a concept amongst people on both sides of the border that there are genuine areas for cooperation that can, over a period of time, change people's attitudes. And we'll see where we end up. So it's a question of do the actions first and then see how that impacts on public opinion.
And isn't it interesting that that's working? Because if we think about the negotiations around the Good Friday Agreement, it was cooperation on those sorts of softer matters that really scared the horses, the unionist horses.
Yeah, they did, and there's no doubt, and they'll do so again. And we're going to have situations over the next couple of years, you know, in the world of Rumsfeld, the unknown unknowns in a way, about tariffs, for instance. If the US, if Trump imposes tariffs on Europe that are different to the ones that are imposed on the UK, then the tariffs that Northern Ireland will face are the European Union tariffs because they're part of the single market. So all of these things are going to create tempers in Stormont amongst unions who aren't happy about any discussion on any of these kind of issues. Mm-hmm. And they're going to... I don't think he sees any value in poking the bear when there's no need to do it. The other thing to bear in mind is when the programme for government was being negotiated, there was an aversion to talking about unification. Fine Gael put the word objective into their manifesto. That word had been used by Leo Varadkar, as John said, in his speech in yes. Ireland's Future. They had to put the word in, because if they hadn't, then frankly the question is, well, why aren't you using the language of your former Taoiseach? But that's as far as they had any interest in going. And then when they got into the programme for government talks, talking to people who were on the margins of a lot of this stuff, they were saying that any mention of this was provoking a response. And the argument that was coming back was, this is not what people are telling us they want to do. So the politician's judgment is that 64% of people, every time they're asked by the Irish Times and Irons, will say, we want unity and we'd vote for it tomorrow. The politicians don't believe the people. They believe that what they're getting on the door is, we want you to go away and sort out crime, housing, immigration. We don't want you to have airy-fairy conversations about constitutional issues. And there is a residue left from last year's failed constitutional referendums that people don't want to have conversations about things unless they see that they're real and immediate in their lives at the moment.
Well, John mentioned costs there. I mean, 64% might say they want it, but then when they're asked if it's going to cost you money, what do they say?
Well, I mean, the figures drop away usually. Yeah. I mean, all of these questions. The problem that there is that there hasn't been an adult conversation on the island about what all of this means. The vast majority of people in the South, if so far they've thought about this issue at all, see a 32-county Ireland being a bigger version of 26. If that's the road we go down, that will be a road to disaster. If we are genuine about wanting to create a 32-county Ireland, it has to be a Wolfe-Tone Ireland, not a Wolfe-Tones Ireland. Mm-hmm. We have to find some way to bring in people whose identity we disagree with, we're uncomfortable with, or who frankly on occasions just bloody well annoy us.
Yeah, find a way to do it. John, do you agree with that assessment?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the economic issues that need to be resolved, first of all is the issue of salary alignment, because people in the Republic are paid more than in the North. Then there's the issue of higher housing costs. And I think the third big one is, how much will the British government, if there is to be Irish unity, will the British government pick up the tab for certain things to ease the cost of transition to unity? For example, those working in the Northern Ireland Civil Service who became part of an All-Ireland Civil Service, what about their pensions when they quit work? Who's going to pay for them? Would the UK government pay their pensions, given they'd worked for the UK government, in some cases for many decades, or would the Irish government have to pick up all the costs? So you see some of the issues, and that's why a prospectus really needs to be written that will deal with those issues and not avert them. Now, you can write a long prospectus and still not get the idea of independence over the line. Ask the Scottish National Party. They managed to write a 672-page prospectus for Scottish independence, and they still lost the referendum. That said, at the start of that campaign, support for Scottish independence was only around in the 30% mark. It went up substantially when the prospectus was written, simply not enough to get it over the line. So I think we can expect, if there was to be a clear prospectus for United Ireland, I'd expect support to increase. There is the fact that in the North, the gap is narrowing between supporters of Northern Ireland staying in the UK and support for United Ireland. Even if you don't trust the poll fully this week that shows that the gap is only 7 percentage points, because that does look an outlier. The average gap in the other polls, I mean, Mark mentioned the Aaron's poll, the Irish Times, the gap there was 14 percentage points, and we found exactly the same in the University of Liverpool study of the last general election in Northern Ireland. So let's take, if you split the difference, say 10 percentage points, that's not an unbridgeable gap in terms of the North, but it's still some way to go before a British Secretary of State would call a border poll. And you can bet your life the British Secretary of State will put it off until the last minute, until that legal challenge comes. I mean, at the moment, the other point to make is there's no fixed criteria as to when a border poll should be called, other than that it's in the view of the Secretary of State that there's a majority in favour of constitutional change within the North. So the Secretary of State can ignore election results that show unionist and nationalist polling pretty equally in Northern Ireland, and instead prefer the comfort, the constitutional comfort of opinion polls suggesting there's still more people want Northern Ireland to stay in the UK. That was something that wasn't really thought about in the Good Friday Agreement. No one really envisaged Sinn Féin becoming the largest party. No one really envisaged the fall in the Unionist bloc vote by 10% that we've seen since the Good Friday Agreement. So we're in uncertain territory. The gap is closing, but it's not closing at a rate that we're going to have a border poll. I don't think there'll be a border poll within the next 10 years, but if you ask me, would there be a border poll within the next 2025, then I wouldn't necessarily rule it out.
Mm-hmm. And who is writing the prospectus on what it might look like post-unification?
Well, no one at the moment. I mean, Sinn Féin is and Ireland's future, the two are inextricably linked, but they're not entirely the same organisations, and Ireland's future has invited a whole range of different speakers to its events. They're trying to have the discussion to try and sort of analyse what unionist fears are, what a united Ireland might look like, and they are adopting quite pluralist language of the the need to accept the British unionist identity in the north. But we're still in the starting stalls in terms of actually writing a document that says, okay, this is what it would look like, and this is what we'll be voting on, because ultimately there will have to be obviously referenda on both sides of the border. Again, the Good Friday Agreement isn't absolutely precise about the timing of that, but the assumption is they would be simultaneous, but it's only an assumption. And at that point, you know, I think it's really important, given that, you know, the UK experience of Brexit, where people didn't have a clue what they were voting on. It's really important that people know what they're voting on, should an Irish unity referendum ever come about.
Listen, we'll leave that one there. Very interesting to talk to you both, Professor John Tong and Mark Hennessy from the Irish Times. Thank you for being with us.